You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Way up in the hills, above Santa Barbara, at the end of a winding maze of narrow and steep streets, you're going to find Don Vogt's mid-century home. And on the back patio, you can hear the birds chirping as the view stretches from red tile roofs of the city out to sea. In this little perch of what's known as the Riviera neighborhood, when one of the hillside homes went up for sale not too long ago, people were curious to meet their new neighbor. And being an affable guy, Don went down to introduce himself to whom he thought might be the person moving in. Instead, he found a
bouncy young lady who said, "Oh, no, you're going to have 8 neighbors." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Yes, it's been bought by a company called Picasso." And I'm thinking of the artist. And so she said, "No, it's Pacaso. And they buy the house and then sell ownership parcels to as many as 8 other people."
You see, Don doesn't want 8 neighbors because, in his opinion, that's not what this sleek single-family home close to his is for.
That didn't kind of sit well because it sounded an awful lot like a timeshare right in our backyard here.
Is that legal? Well, by selling slices of ownership in a luxury vacation home, managing the property, and scheduling limited time stays for those buyers, Picasso asserts its business model is above board. And as many communities are finding out, it is legal for now. It's important to disclose here that Picasso is a KCRW underwriter. KCRW's Matt Gillum picks up the story from here.
Paying for a company to schedule private homeowners to use their own home may not be illegal yet, but Santa Barbara City Councilwoman Kristen Sneddon wants to change that. Her district includes Don Vogt's house in the Riviera, and she'd like her council colleagues to put the kibosh on the monetized model Picasso is using by enacting an ordinance stating
that we just do not allow fractional ownership. That type of use is not allowed in single-family residence zones, and that's it.
The company's model brings together up to 8 families in an LLC to fractionally own the property as a second home. In a house with 8 co-owners, each is entitled to up to 44 nights a year at the property, with a single stay lasting up to 2 weeks. Residents book their time at the home using an app from the company. Sneddon is skeptical of the syntax.
Fractional ownership to me is just a euphemism for timeshare, and it just means that you have more of a share to control.
Like many cities in California, Santa Barbara doesn't allow timeshares in residential neighborhoods. The regular churn of people, the coming and going, doesn't fit with the zoned use of the area, nor does a professionally managed commercial venture. Setting aside the issue with zoning, Sneddon says buying up single-family homes, even luxury properties, raises another issue.
We're about 8,000 units short of where we need to be for people who already work in this city. So we don't have enough housing for the people who are here.
As Santa Barbara's legal team explores the city's regulatory options, they're keeping a close eye on some other communities that have already taken decisive action when it comes to newcomer Picasso. The real estate startup was founded in late 2020 by former Zillow execs. Carmel, South Lake Tahoe, and Palm Springs have sent cease and desist notices to the company. Each of the cities asserts Picasso is violating their timeshare ordinances. Palm Springs is no stranger to real estate innovations, let's say. The city has spent the last decade using trial and error to come up with regulations for short-term vacation rentals. Outgoing city manager Justin Clifton worries the fractional ownership model piloted by Picasso could be the next round of regulatory whack-a-mole.
The biggest concern among residents is it will expand that activity that, you know, walks and talks and looks like a vacation rental property. In other words, the owners aren't in the middle of their regular daily lives, either as working individuals or maybe retired at home enjoying a peaceful, quiet neighborhood, but are rather in a more vacation mode.
Remember, each stay at an 8-family Picasso is capped at 2 weeks. Whether a city opposes it because it's too much like a vacation rental or they view it as a timeshare, Picasso's chief marketing officer, Whitney Curry, is adamant it's neither.
Picasso is co-ownership. Co-ownership is real estate property ownership. So when you own a timeshare, you do not actually own real estate. Instead, you own the right to use time in a property. Picasso owners own real estate just as if you're going about purchasing a whole home.
Furthermore, Curry says the argument that Picasso takes needed homes off the market holds no water in a town that's full of second homes that sit empty for part of the year anyway. In fact, she says it's the opposite.
Picasso is creating additive inventory by consolidating demand. Multiple families can purchase one home together and use that home consistently all throughout the year.
Are the houses in constant use? I set off to try and catch a Coachella Valley Picasso owner at home.
All right, we are at the Palm Springs Picasso house. It's 110 degrees. Let's go see if anybody's home. Pushed what looks like a doorbell, and nobody's coming to the door. All right, we're in the car. We have left the Palm Springs house. We're now heading towards Palm Desert, a little further down in the Coachella Valley.
I checked out three Palm Desert Picassos. Each was fairly similar. Clean modern lines, gleaming white paint, and nobody home. Sure, the searing summer heat makes the desert less appealing. At one point, my car said 121 degrees. But among the three homes that could have up to two dozen owners, not a one was in. While the visit was a bust, and Picasso owners did not respond to calls and emails for this story, some made a point of being present at a May meeting of the Palm Desert City Council when the leaders were considering tightening the city's timeshare rules. Colorado resident David Durham was among the fractional owners to call in and extol his Picasso experience. He said his family's been visiting the Coachella Valley for years, but since he's still not quite ready to retire, going all in on a home in Palm Desert isn't in the cards yet.
So Picasso was a great way for us to have an ownership stake in a great house, let Picasso maintain it, and share it with other people that have a vested interest financially to take care of the property. It is not a timeshare. We are a 1/8 owner in an LLC.
Another fractional owner called in and made a point Picasso highlights in an economic study it commissioned. They're not pinching pennies when they come to town.
We don't throw parties. We spend money, basically, in your town.
Jill Muller, also of Colorado, said she bought a stake in a desert house because her kids live in L.A. and this provides a good meeting place. While mentioning she knew the neighbors on both sides, the bottom line was the bottom line.
I spent $600 at your beautiful Sundance store on El Paseo. We also went to many restaurants there. I mean, we're just bringing in thousands of dollars to your community between groceries, food, golf.
Ultimately, the comments did little to sway local leaders. Here's Palm Desert City Councilwoman Kathleen Kelly.
To the average person, it waddles like a timeshare. It quacks like a timeshare.
And so they decided to tighten their timeshare rules, giving Palm Desert a bit more legal oomph should they want it in the future. Whitney Curry, with Picasso, says the company is open to regulations. It's recently established a government advisory board.
We're working with the communities collaboratively to engage in dialogue and are very open to having a discussion around a reasonable regulatory framework that can address co-owned housing.
Officials in the desert say talks are happening and that while they proceed, the company is holding off on buying new homes in their communities. As Picasso, the cities, and an army of lawyers iron out the definition of a timeshare, back in Santa Barbara, Don Vogt is taking action from his hilltop hideaway. He's joined up with an outfit based in Sonoma County called Stop Picasso Now, which, well, you can figure out what they want. The group's reach spreads from Maui to Long Island. Here in the Riviera neighborhood, he's taken the lead on a signage campaign.
You've seen my No Picasso signs out here. They're popping up everywhere. And, you want one?
I didn't take one, but enough residents in the neighborhood have the bright yellow placards out front that when whoever lives in the fractionally owned home drives up, they're definitely seeing the No Picasso sign. For KCRW, I'm Matt Gillum in Santa Barbara.
Still to come on GLA, relics from a community of the past exist even today. How East Hollywood was home to Japanese boarding houses a century ago. More on that after this quick break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and the beat goes on. This weekend marks the start of Nisei Week in Los Angeles, a time of year when taiko drumming and traditional music and colorful parades take over the streets of downtown's historic Little Tokyo district. But Little Tokyo hasn't always been the center of Japanese culture in LA. During the first half of the 20th century, East Hollywood was the site of a tightly knit Japanese immigrant community known as Madison J Flats. The area just south of present-day Virgil Village was home to boarding houses where Japanese immigrants could seek out affordable rent, home-cooked meals, and, yes, community. Today, only one of those boarding houses still functions, and its tenants are fighting to stay in place. Samantha Helu Hernandez is co-founder of the Making a Neighborhood newsletter, and she took a deep dive into the history of East Hollywood's Japanese boarding houses, and she joins us right now. Hi, Samantha.
Thank you for having me.
There was an influx of Japanese immigration to L.A. around the turn of the century, right? This was turn of the 19th to the 20th century. By the 1920s and 30s, the part of East Hollywood, then known as I mentioned, Madison and J Flats, took shape. Can you paint a picture?
Yeah. So that particular part of East Hollywood, it's just south of Melrose. And it was actually, you know, back in the day, like a lot of parts of L.A., a lot of farmland. There was actually a formerly enslaved Black man who was one of the first legislators in Mississippi who came to the area in 1892 and homesteaded the land. And him and his family saw as the neighborhood evolved into city blocks and as Japanese people started coming in because of waves of agricultural workers and a need for laborers in general. So the city, that part of the city, took shape as this diverse enclave that was very predominantly Japanese at the same time. So slowly Virgil Avenue, which is still kind of the main artery of that neighborhood, became this Japanese enclave. There were barber shops. There was a Japanese market. There were car garages where you could get your car fixed. And there were these boarding houses as well, right, that like helped recent immigrants get on their feet, find employment, have room and board, be able to speak their language and have meals.
Enter the Ozawas. Talk a little bit about this family and what role their boarding houses played in the lives of the Japanese immigrants who were just adjusting to American life.
Yeah, so the Ozawas were very instrumental in the neighborhood. They came from Japan in the early 1900s, and like a lot of Japanese people, worked in agriculture and slowly made their way to the East Hollywood area where they had a produce stand. And Suya Ozawa, who was an incredibly industrious woman, as her descendants, you know, describe her, she was educated and started saving up money and purchasing properties. So one of the properties that they bought was their first house, which was built in 1912, and they bought it in 1914. And at the time, it was a bungalow. And eventually in 1924, they converted it into a boarding house with 23 rooms. And that was to help house these recent immigrants. They lived on site, as was common with boarding houses. And, you know, the women really took a central role in running these boarding houses and cooking. It was really a family affair. And eventually the family, you know, there was another boarding house right next door that included an employment agency. So many times these boarding houses also had employment agencies, which helped find jobs for these boarders. They bought a house in the street just behind these boarding houses. So they really started to shape the neighborhood and even contributed to the formation of the Japanese language school and a judo dojo in the neighborhood. So they were really instrumental in shaping this little pocket of Los Angeles.
And you got a chance to talk with one of the descendants, right, of the Ozawas who actually grew up in and around these houses.
Yeah, I actually spoke to four of the Ozawa descendants. I spoke with Edith and Joseph Ozawa. They are the grandchildren of the first Ozawas. And they grew up around, you know, basically in the boarding houses. They lived at first in one of the boarding houses. And then as their family bought more properties, they moved to a house that was right behind. And they just remember it being like this kind of community space. There weren't really any fences to block the boarding houses and their houses. So it was just kind of hybrid. Kids would come from the neighborhood and they would play in the backyard where there was a koi pond. They helped, you know, Edith remembers because her mother, Shizuka Ozawa, really took over from her mother-in-law in running the day-to-day operations of the boarding houses. So she remembers having to help her mom, you know, pack sandwiches for lunch for the men the next day and helping to serve the food. So it was really a family affair taking care of these boarding houses. And they really do, you know, the grandchildren and the children, they really do have fond memories of growing up around these houses.
I mean, we're painting this, you know, idyllic picture, but at the same time, here in America, certainly before World War II, and then certainly after World War II, but we had, you know, there were discriminatory policies, obviously, for many immigrants, not just Japanese, but many immigrants as well. And then you had, after the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, Japanese people put in internment camps. So this was a very difficult time, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of those discriminatory policies, you know, come even before the war. You know, they're in neighboring neighborhoods like Los Feliz, which was predominantly white. There were racially restrictive covenants, which did not allow non-white people from purchasing property. So that already created segregation in the city. And then redlining happened in 1939, which, you know, gave grades to different neighborhoods based on their, basically their racial makeup. And oftentimes, if a neighborhood was diverse, it was considered risky for investment, which led to a lot of disinvestment and white flight from those neighborhoods. So these policies kind of created segregation, but at the same time created these very diverse enclaves, which were the only places a lot of people could live. And for example, with the Ozawas, they were facing discriminatory policies since the 20s, where they couldn't, if you were Japanese born, you couldn't own property. So what a lot of Japanese Americans or Japanese born immigrants did is they had to put the names of their properties and like their babies' names, you know, even though they were just babies. So they were facing these things since the 20s and 30s. And then obviously with World War II, this community was uprooted because they were sent to internment camps. Those Ozawas were sent to Heart Mountain, Wyoming. And thankfully, because of their ties in the community, non-Japanese neighbors and community members took care of their property. So when they came back, it was still theirs and they were taken care of.
Yeah, there was certainly an infamous Japanese internment camp here in Southern California, right? Manzanar.
Right, correct.
Yeah. They were able to hang on to their property after internment, though there have been a number of ownership changes since then. The last Japanese family to own the boarding houses sold both of them to a developer. So what's going on with the properties right now?
Right. So in February of 2021, the properties were sold to a developer, and the person who bought it gave a lot of cash for keys offers to a lot of the tenants because there were tenants in both of the properties, which are right next to each other. And the property next door to the one that still works as a boarding house has been basically cleared and it's undergoing renovation. But the one that still stands at 564, that's still operating as a boarding house, has seven elderly Japanese tenants that live there. And most of them only speak Japanese and they'd been living there for decades at this point. They're single Japanese men who worked as laborers in various fields, even as gardeners, kind of continuing that legacy of Japanese gardeners in the United States. And, you know, according to organizers that have been helping to organize the tenants and some of the tenants that I spoke with, they've faced some habitability issues due to the construction that's been happening next door and in the top floor of the building, which was cleared of tenants. During the winter months, their heaters weren't working. So a lot of advocates had to donate blankets, space heaters. One of the tenants, James Nimi, who was actually from Hawaii, he's Japanese American. He said he even had to buy a sleeping bag to stay warm because, you know, these are men that are in their 70s and 80s. So, you know, heat changes in temperature can really impact them. So that those are some of the things they've been going through. And as a result, there's been this coalition of various community members, tenant organizers, and organizations that have kind of come together to organize the tenants and fight for them to have safe living conditions and to continue to be able to have affordable rent and live safely. One of the things that's pretty significant about this story is that these men are continuing a 100-year legacy almost, right, of Japanese immigrants living in this house and using it as a place to have affordable rent, to have room and board. And one of the reasons that advocates are really fighting for this house is because it's not just a relic of the past, right? If you think about our housing and homelessness crisis in Los Angeles, housing of this type is still very much needed in the city. It's not just something in the past. So there's also very much parallels that connect our past and our history to the present.
Well, thank you for talking with us. I know you do these deep dives into the history of East Hollywood and connecting to the issues that are still happening today. Samantha Helu Hernandez, who's reporting on East Hollywood, is there at the Making a Neighborhood newsletter. You can subscribe to it to read the rest of the story and other stories as well. Samantha, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's gotten a lot of attention after some city officials wanted San Clemente to become a so-called sanctuary for life city. Just another day in Orange County. It started as a proposal by City Councilman Stephen Knobloch, which included language that, quote, life begins at conception, end quote, and would stand, the city would, stand against letting any facility open that performed abortions. But after a contentious meeting on Saturday where dozens upon dozens of residents showed up, mostly decrying the proposal, the council voted 3-1 to remove it. Here to tell us more is Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, and of course one of our regulars here at GLA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
All right, let's talk about the resolution. What was it supposed to do?
Honestly, just be performative politics. I mean, ostensibly, it was meant to ban any place in the, within the city limits of San Clemente, ban any place that might want to offer abortions. And the language, though, if you read it, it was really just a statement against abortion. As you mentioned earlier, it stated that life begins at conception. So it wasn't really so much city policy as it was a philosophical statement pushed forth by the council member, Steve Knobloch.
Are there any abortions performed right now in San Clemente?
No, not any abortion providers. You know, if women are taking morning after pills or something, that's a whole other thing. But in the city of San Clemente, there's not. The closest facilities are up the 5 freeway in Mission Viejo, which, again, is not San Clemente's. And not only that, let's not forget, the state of California is working to enshrine abortion rights or the access to abortion in the state constitution. So if this were to pass, you know, Gavin Newsom himself would be driving down the 5 to San Clemente and handing Knobloch, you know, the state's lawsuit against the city.
How did this even become a talking point? Was this is Roe versus Wade and the overturning of it by the Supreme Court?
Yeah, you're seeing this all across the United States, and you have had other cities and municipalities pass these so-called sanctuary life cities, counties, or whatnot. So the politics, obviously, the people who are against abortion, if they're running for politics or they're already in an elected position, they're going to lean on that because they think that's going to be able to get them more political votes. But of course, the uproar about it is from the other side, people who are for abortion rights. And so anytime you have something that reeks of limiting abortion rights, kind of like what we saw in Kansas, where the voters voted down a resolution that voted down a proposition that would limit abortion rights. And so that's exactly what happened in San Clemente. You had the pro-abortion crowd come in and tell San Clemente, no, you're not gonna get away with this.
It wasn't just Councilman Knobloch, though, who was for this proposal. He was the one who put forth the proposal. But there were other city council members, other city leaders who were for this. And then this change of heart. So was it the meeting on Saturday? Is that what changed the hearts?
No, you already had Mayor Gene James before the Saturday meeting saying, I'm for this resolution, but then he saw the political winds. And so immediately these people and he even said, like, I'm for abortion, you know, I'm pro-life, but there's different gradations of pro-life. So he said, this is not my version of pro-life. I cannot stand by this. At least that's what he said. But really, when you have all these people, especially residents of San Clemente, overwhelmingly speaking out against this proposed resolution, he knew that if he was going to stay in the position with Knobloch, that doesn't win him any votes at all.
You mentioned Kansas. You know, was this reaction there in South Orange County, you know, kind of like the recent vote there in Kansas, you know, more about individual freedom than sort of a referendum on reproductive rights?
This is yet another referendum on the changing state of Orange County. San Clemente is a very Republican city. And yet, even for those people, abortion access is important. It wasn't a bunch of blue folks from other cities in Orange County coming down. These are residents who are saying no. And of course, there was some people who spoke in favor of Knobloch's resolution. Even a decade ago, you'd have politicians with some of these cockamamie resolutions and they would pass and there'd be, you know, no one would really care about it. But the fact that they stood down from this is pretty extraordinary.
I mean, you think that's a bellwether? You say, and we've talked about on this program many times, that Orange County is changing. The demographics are changing. The political aspects are changing. Is that what's going on here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you saw in Kansas, that's more of a rural Midwestern state. Orange County is the epitome of suburbia. You know, this is a place that San Clemente once had a QAnon believing council member not too long ago. And so the fact that now we're at this point, it is going to be a very interesting midterms in 2022. And remember, the Republicans are trying to hold on to what they have in terms of the state assembly, state senate, and also Congress. But the Democrats are on the march. And very tellingly, the assembly member who represents San Clemente, Laurie Davies, she spoke out against this proposed resolution, and she's a Republican. So if you have Republicans going against resolutions that are ostensibly pro-life, that tells you a lot about what they're expecting the voters are going to be caring about this coming November.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist of the LA Times, of course, every week here on Greater LA. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Remembering the great Olivia Newton-John today. That's going to do it for us on Greater Xanadu, Greater LA. Tomorrow, think skateboarding for your fingers. You're going to meet the local fingerboarding champion in Orange County tomorrow on GLA. And later in the week, off to NoHo, North Hollywood. The biggest concentration of live theaters was hit hard by the pandemic. What's the scene like there now? That's this week on Greater LA, always online at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast, too, won't you? Zoe Matthew, Rebecca Ludman, Ted Robbins, Jay Siebold, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's episode happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears. Have a great night.